What's up, everybody? It's Michael Tucker with the Real Estate Success Strategies Podcast. Today, I'm so pumped because we have Tucker Merrihew in the building. He's right here on us. And actually, I'm so pumped because he is the first one for our live podcast show. So Tucker, congratulations, brother. We're kicking off our live podcast show and you're one of the first to be on here. So I appreciate it. But guys, listen, today's podcast is going to be amazing because Tucker is going to show you guys and talk about how he's been able to build a multi-million dollar a year real estate company, you know, while also doing the Real Deals podcast and doing many other things, including creating the Driving for Dollars app. And so today, guys, you're going to want to make sure you get that pen and paper out, that notebook out, so you can take notes for this event. So, Tucker, how's it going, man? Welcome to the show.
It's good, man. It's I appreciate you having me. We're on the back end of Christmas, so as a father of two young toddlers, I can kind of take a little bit of a sigh of relief because Christmas is a little chaotic. So
that's awesome, man.
I'm happy to be here today.
But I was going to say, I'm pumped to have you, man. Just tell our audience, a lot of these people that are here with us today, you know, they are, you know, kind of newer to real estate, just getting in. And so just let everybody know who you are and what you do currently.
Sure. Yeah. I've, let's see. Well, obviously I'm Tucker on the front end, not the back end. You got a last name. Usually Tucker's either a dog's name or somebody's last name, right? So that's the norm. It's actually my middle name, but my dad's name is Tim also. So I've always gone by Tucker. So there you go. A little background on me. In terms of real estate, you know, I've been in the real estate game for God, since 2002, at this point. So it's been a long time. I got into it with the intention of always wanting to be in the investment side. You know, the allure of buying and selling real estate and making a profit always kind of appealed to me. And, you know, I kind of fell into it as a loan officer first, selling money, basically mortgages, right?
Right.
And that was kind of my in. That was my way to create income, right? Because you want to get into real estate. Everybody wants to get into real estate. There's usually some lag time between getting into real estate and actually making income. And right. So getting into the loan side of the game, it allowed me to generate some more some active income quicker in the world of real estate while still being involved. And then at the same time, trying to get my feelers out there and understand the real estate investment game, the house buying game. And it took a little while for sure, but that was kind of my my bridge to it, so to speak, because I'd gone to a, you know, seminar just like everybody, and they, you know, told you could be a millionaire in a year and this and that, which is, you know, true to some extent with the right skills, I guess. It's not the norm, but it got me excited. And so I wanted to do all those things, but out of the box, like, how do you create an income and stay in the world of real estate? And so doing loans was kind of the best case scenario. So I did that for a while. I ended up being a top producing loan officer. So I ended up being pretty good at it. I didn't love it, just to be totally honest. It was, you know, the mortgage side of this business is it's a grind. It's just,
right.
It's a grind for sure. And so through that, you know, eventually I became a top producing loan officer. I then started my own mortgage company, which just seemed like the next logical step. What I didn't realize was at the time was that becoming a business owner and being a great salesperson are two entirely different seats that you sit in. And so I learned a lot in that process. I hired a lot of the wrong people, you know, had a lot of heartache and headache, but I grew as a person. I did get to be a much better business owner through that process. And then eventually, you know, 2007, 2008, 2009 hit, and the world of mortgages completely got turned on its head. And so at that point, I decided, okay, that's probably a great segue to be able to get into the investment side of the business full time. I'd been kind of one foot in, one foot out at that point, doing some projects, some house hacks, some, you know, flip here and there. But at that point, that's when I said, okay, I'm stepping away from the mortgage game. I'm going full time into the investment game, which was a little bit counterintuitive at the time because 2008, everybody was running from real estate. And that was the point where I kind of doubled down and I went all in just on the investment side. And so that was a crazy time, but it was end of 2008 when I started TTM Development Company, which is now our flagship company. It's the one that builds, you know, all the high-end houses and then also does all the big renovation projects that we do. So that was, you know, 11, 12 years ago now, something like that. And since then, of course, we've, you know, changed the types of projects that we've done. We've gone up in price point. You know, so we started basically renovating little hood house, you know, ranch style hood houses. And now we're building, you know, $3+ million homes, which for Portland is a very expensive house. So it's been quite the ride. And along the way, we've done a number of other things that we can probably talk about as well.
Awesome, man. Well, I have so many questions to ask you because your journey seems very vast. And one of the questions I wanted to touch on and kind of ask was your experience in the mortgage industry, did that help you and aid you in any way in your, you know, investment journey, do you feel like? Do you think you had an advantage because of that?
I think so. I mean, ultimately, that's why I was in it, right? I knew at the time that if I could learn how the money works, I could figure the rest out, and that would be a huge asset for me. So I did. I learned how the money worked. It's definitely helped me today when I raise private money for a lot of our projects. Like, I understand the securitization of people's money and the insurance and all those things that make them feel comfortable on an investment level, right? And so I understand how all those things work, and that's really helped, you know, us raise millions and millions of dollars as we need them. I mean, right now we have more potential lenders than we have projects, you know, which is a good problem to have. But having that knowledge and that understanding of how it all works, it just, it breeds confidence in people when you talk to them on the private lender front. And so, yeah, I'm glad that I went through that. I understand it all really well. And now I can kind of use that information in the investment side of the business as well.
Love it, man. And so I was sitting here listening to your story, and I was really fond of the point wherever you said 2007 to 2009, that 2008 area, you know, when everybody else was running and selling and, you know, getting out, you were getting in. And what was your mindset behind that? Because I know you said you'd been wishy-washy, you'd been in and out doing real estate. But what was your mindset at that time? Because there's a lot of people right now, and I guess we can probably touch on that this in a little bit, but there's a lot of people right now that are like, hey, is 2021 going to be another 2008, right? Is this upcoming year going to be another, you know, burst, you know? So what was your mindset back at that time? Whenever you were getting into, you said, okay, now's the time to switch from the mortgage side to the flipping side or investing side. What was your mindset behind that?
Yeah, well, let me say first off, 2021 is very different than 2008. What happens? I don't have a crystal ball, but I have my thoughts that we can get into. But at that point, you know, I segued. That was a good segue because I no longer had the ability to make income, all right, in the mortgage game. It was very different. So it kind of forced me to go a different direction. But my mindset was, you know, everybody's running away from it, so I'm going to kind of run towards it. But I also understood something, which is real estate always sells at the right price. It's not like, you know, Bitcoin, for example, right? Right now it's on a crazy run up, but when it's falling, nobody wants to touch it, right? There's no backstop to it. There's no, I mean, you can argue whether or not there's a true use for it, right? And so because that true use is not completely defined yet, it could fall until, you know, probably people step in and buy it and prop the price up. But with real estate, there's a use for it, right? Housing, people need it. And so it can only fall so far. Now, certain markets in 2008 fell farther than others. A lot of that had to do with the fact that there was more speculation in those markets leading up to it, like a Phoenix or a place like that, which is now the epicenter for all, you know, tons of real estate investors, a lot of which I know. But, you know, those markets got crushed because a lot of those same real estate investors were getting a bunch of, you know, highly leveraged loan products to speculate and buy real estate. And when real estate started to get soft, those loans went bad, and there was this giant influx of property into the market. And so, you know, we knew that people would always buy real estate. We just had to buy it at a built-in discount. And so we got really good at that point in time, recognizing how much of a discount we needed to buy at in order to then be able to reposition the asset, put it back in the market, and let it be absorbed by the market, right? And so that's basically what we did. And, you know, to say that it wasn't a little nerve-wracking, I'd be lying. I mean, there was a few times, I mean, I remember the first one we did, I self-funded the whole thing because at that point in 2008, hard money was, they were gone, right? There was, nobody was lending in this world you know, real estate, a house flipping, like the hard money companies had packed up. I mean, there was this terrible story of a guy in Phoenix that I think killed himself because his hard money company was so overextended on a bunch of stuff that was just falling in value. Right. So it was, and especially here in Portland, like we were a smaller market. There were no like local hard money companies at that time. Now there's a number that I'm, you know, I know well, but point is I had to self fund that first deal in 2008 as we kind of hit the beginning of that reset button. And I was nervous, but I self-funded like I think we got one, we bought it for like 102,000 or something like that. So I self-funded it, did all the rehab. And then once we got done, we sold it in like a week for just under 200,000. So I was like, oh my God, I guess this works. Right. But the other thing I realized too, is that even in a down market, like there's your foreclosure market inventory and there's your turnkey retail buyer inventory. And these two markets can exist at the same time, but not really affect each other too much. So there was a lot of foreclosure inventory. There was a lot of beat up inventory and those were selling, but they were almost like a completely different market because it was a completely different buyer. So like looking forward, like a lot of people are saying, oh, all these forbearances are going to lead to large amounts of foreclosures and that's going to drag down the market. If that was the case, I don't believe that it's really going to drag down the market. But my thoughts on that, because we're in that topic, so might as well discuss it, is that right now, you know, there's a lot of equity in these homes. People have a lot of equity, right? And the only way that that equity is going to disappear is two reasons. One is inventory spikes a huge amount. And in conjunction with that, interest rates spike a huge amount, right? The likelihood of that happening in the next year, both of those things, very unlikely. There was a small window of time where it sort of happened in end of 2018, where interest rates spiked up above, it was like 4.5%, which we thought, oh my God, money's so expensive. When I got into the mortgage game, interest rates were like 6.5%, right? And we thought it was cheap.
Having a conversation about that,
yeah,
too.
It's all relative, but they've been low for so long now that the price of the money has now dictated the price of the assets to some extent. So, you know, the Fed has come out and said they're going to keep rates low through 2023 or whatever it is, right? So as long as rates are low, the only other factor really is going to be inventory. And we've learned that even through this coronavirus, you know, mess, there's still a decent amount of the population that wants to buy real estate, right? And has a job, because that's why real estate's so hot right now. So we can shelf that for now, as far as employment being an issue for people to buy houses. So the two biggest factors are going to be inventory and cost of money. Cost of money is going to stay low because it has to for the next year. Inventory is at historic lows across the entire country. I mean, we've got 1 month of inventory, which is the lowest it's ever been since they've been keeping records here in the Portland metro area. And many other metros are in the exact same boat. So as long as that's the case, I mean, you know, I painted a pretty good picture here for everybody else to kind of, or everybody that's listening to kind of, okay, well, what's going to happen in 2021? You can kind of make your own decision. But personally, I believe that it's going to continue to be a pretty strong year in real estate. And, you know, even some of the biggest economists have come out and said that they expect real estate to appreciate by another 5 or 6%, maybe more in some markets. I don't know. This past year, we've had 15% year-over-year appreciation, which does scare me, I'll be honest, because anytime you get 15% in 1 year, it's going to come with a backlash of some sort. It's just what that backlash looks like. In 2007, 2008, we had those same numbers. Actually, it was 2006 that we had those same numbers, and that was right on the edge of things collapsing. But the reason why those numbers, those appreciation numbers were so high is because there was so much speculation driving the market. Now, it's not speculation. It's actual home buyers buying with true down payments. There's no liar's loans. There's no stated income, stated asset loans at super high loan to values. So I think that at that point in time, I was a little concerned, right? Obviously, I put my money where my mouth was and I did a deal and it worked. And then we just did it over and over again. But now looking forward, you know, into 2021, I'm not really that concerned, because I think worst case, we have a slight uptick in inventory. But if that forbearance inventory actually turns into foreclosure inventory, there are so many investors starved for deals right now. They will gobble those up so quickly. It's unbelievable. Right. And so the absorption rate on those deals is just going to be off the charts. So I think that we've got a long ways to go of that kind of slough foreclosure potential inventory before it actually would impact the market overall. So long answer to a short question, but there you go.
No, man. I love it. And it's so true. I'm in Kentucky, so you're on the other side of the United States, but we're seeing the same thing over here. You know, demand is high. You know, actually today we just bought a house that was in pre-foreclosure. So, you know, the houses are coming, but investors, like you said, I feel like we'll scoop it up as well. So, dude, everything you said was on point. So after you got that, you know, you did that first deal, 2008, you know, timeframe, and you flipped that one, you said, okay, this is going to work. Did you keep investing with your own money or did you start looking for, you know, private money in that time? What did that look like as far as scaling up your business in that timeframe?
Yeah. So we did a couple that I self-funded, just to kind of proof the concept, because remember, take a time machine back to 2008, 2009, everybody, you know, people were pulling money out of the bank. They were, you know, worried about FDIC insured accounts. The world, everybody thought it was going to end there for a few months, right? Like it was pretty bad. And so finding people to lend on real estate at that moment in time was a little challenging because a lot of people had taken it in the, you know, taken a shot to the nose across the board financially. But we did a couple of deals and then we went out and we found, you know, a couple of private individuals that, you know, had not really been exposed to what had happened and they still had their war chest of cash. And so about two deals in is when I decided, okay, look, I've only got the bandwidth to do like a deal and a half, maybe two deals at a time, self-funding, which isn't going to be enough for us to kind of grow the company, right? So that was the point where I went out and I found some individuals and we used private money and that was the beginning of it. And we started with a small amount. We raised like $250,000. So, I mean, that sounds like a lot for a lot of markets. Don't get me wrong. It's not a little bit of money, but in our market at that point, that basically funded like maybe one deal plus rehab or two cheaper deals. Right. And then I'd fund rehab, something like that. So we started with $250,000 and then, you know, we grew that to multiple millions of dollars over time. But it started with that smaller amount with that one lender. And we just kind of grew the relationship. We proved what we could do over and over again. And then, you know, we just kind of went from there.
Awesome. And this is a personal question I have. What made you do the transition from the hood, you know, houses we were talking about, you were flipping to now doing higher end homes? Because listen, I've went on your website, dude, the houses this guy is flipping. If you guys are watching this, listening to this later, listen, the houses he's flipping, they're beautiful, man. And so what made you take that transition from doing cheaper houses to wanting to do more complex deals?
It was kind of twofold. One was profit margin, right? So like as you go up in price point, theoretically, you should also go up in profit margin, right? Like that's the idea. 15-20% profit margin on 200,000 versus 400,000. If you maintain those percentages, your profit margin's double, right? So at a certain point, we decided that, okay, you know, there's a lot of people out there that kind of pitch the mantra of, I want to do 100 deals a year, I want to do 200 deals a year, I want to do all these things, right? And I look at that now and I'm like, well, you're going to burn yourself out. You might end up divorced, you might end up with a drinking problem. You know, there's all these things, right? Like there's only so much time you have in your life where you want to run the hamster on the wheel that fast, right? And when you're younger, you're hungry. And I'm not saying I'm not now, but your hunger for success overrides everything else, right? Even your thought process of like, what type of business do I really want to run? All those types of things. And so, you know, we did a higher volume model for a while doing those cheaper houses. And we weren't making as much money as we were on, you know, the first high-end house we did was, I think it was 2010. And we bought the house for $450,000, which at the time was like crazy. I mean, that was like four times plus what we were paying for houses, right? You know, because we were buying it between 100 and 130 and selling between 200 and 220, right? Like that was the bracket. That was the model for the longest time.
I'm in right now buying houses around 100, reselling for around 250.
Yeah. So, you know, to deviate from that so far and then go buy one at 450 was like, oh my God. I mean, and at that point, hard money had started to come back in the market. So we actually had to leverage some hard money with some of our internal capital. So, you know, we pieced together money, we made the deal work. You know, our sellout was going to be somewhere in the sevens, which at that point in time in Portland was like a super expensive house. Now it seems cheap. But again, remember, this was 2010. And so when we did that deal, we finished the house. We literally sold it within the first 10 minutes it was on the market, like that quick. And we sold it to a cash buyer and she closed in like 6 days. And that was the most we'd made on a house by a ton. I mean, I think we made like 160 grand or something like that. And I was like, oh my God, number one, I guess the higher the price point doesn't necessarily mean the higher the risk in terms of selling it. If we can find the capital and we can do these deals, you know, we can make a lot more money. We don't have to do as many deals per se, or we could do, you know, same amount of deals and make a lot more money. But then we ran into some capital. We had to go raise more money beyond that. But we also had to learn, you know, we took on a number of other projects after that, because again, I was hungry. I was like, yeah, we did it. We proofed it. Right. And then we took on a lot of projects that, you know, looking back, it was just so much work. I was like, dang, we should have just knocked that house down. Right. Because we were chasing these bigger margins, but you know, that was part of our growth process too. And eventually we got to the point where we looked at these houses and we were like, why are we doing all this work to them when we could just tear them down and build a nice new house here? And then we could hit an even exponentially higher price point, right? And sell to a even different buyer that's more qualified. And so eventually that, you know, that process turned into tearing houses down and building new houses in their place. So, you know, it was, I guess to answer your question though, you know, we started with the lower dollar houses because we thought the risk was going to be less. But what we found out is that, you know, the risk was probably the same. You know, there really wasn't any more risk necessarily in the higher end. It took a little bit more on the cojones side and to raise a little bit more money. And, you know, once we did that, I was like, well, this is a better way to do this business for sure. And so we just kept kind of doing that. And then, you know, from that process, we kind of started to figure out, okay, what parts of our market, like in your market, right? If you're doing buy at 100, sell at 250, there's probably only a certain few pockets that could accommodate like the 350, 450, $500,000 house, right? And so we had to get more comfortable with understanding, okay, what is a good pocket or a good area to do those higher end projects instead of trying to have an outlier price point in a predominantly lower price point area, right? I don't want to sell a $400,000 or $500,000 house in a predominantly $200,000-$250,000 neighborhood. That's a challenge, right? So, you know, we learned those areas and we've, you know, over time been tightening those areas and tightening those areas in terms of where we want to be. And now this year we're exclusively in Lake Oswego, which is purely, you know, high end comparatively to most of Portland. But even in Lake Oswego, there's areas that are 3 million versus 750, you know? So like we kind of we've learned this over time and we've learned where we wanted to be, but ultimately I didn't want the hamster to run so fast on the wheel. But the second, I guess, part of that question is my wife worked for a production builder in 2006, 7, 8. And in 2008, they basically laid her off and she came to work for me. And what she had done at that point is she ran their custom home division. So she did all of the design selections for all of their custom home that they were building for clients. And so at that point, once they laid her off, she was like, I don't have a job. And I was like, well, we're doing these kind of hood houses. They're not really that fun to design, right? I mean, you're just putting in the same stuff over and over again. I was like, you know, we're going to move up price point. We're going to do a little nicer product. You can start to put your skill set to work in the design arena for the nicer product too, because the market will reward you more for that type of work as you go up in price point as well. And so we kind of grew together and obviously she's gotten better and better at her job over the last 10, 11 years, you know, doing this. And, you know, now we're doing projects for people that are outside of our company here for, you know, $3, $4 million homes that people hire us to do design work and a lot of the construction management as well. So we grew that part of it as well. And so now with those two skill sets together, that's why we're doing kind of less projects, higher price point, nicer areas.
No, makes total sense. So what would be your advice for, okay, I live in a very small town and a lot of these people that are watching, they're kind of the same me. Some of them live in bigger cities, right? But I live in a smaller town where we flip. And, you know, a lot of the population is like around, I don't know, 20, 30,000 people. And so exactly what you were saying earlier, there's only several pockets where the houses are that expensive. And I'm finding that in, even in my area, houses that are, you know, that range of, you know, $500,000 to $1 million, you know, may sit on the market just a little longer. What would you suggest for someone who is in a more of a rural city like me or a smaller city do as it comes to flipping houses? Would it be smart to stay with the cheaper houses or try to scale up and do bigger deals like that?
You know, I don't think there's anything to be afraid of with the bigger deals. I think that you can't skip a few rungs on the ladder though, right? Like you have to gradually grow up in price point. You don't want to jump from 200 to top end for whatever your market is, right? Because there's so much growth that happens in between there, both in terms of like identifying like a truly good property versus just an expensive property. There's a difference, right? Understanding like what a great lot is versus an okay lot. Like you have to grow your real estate investing IQ in addition to growing your real estate investing operation. So that takes time. So I would say, you know, gradually push that price point up, because the other thing you'll find too, and this is kind of the beauty of as you go up price point, there's far less competition, right? So like, you know, we're looking at potentially moving our operation to Phoenix area at some point, right? Which is crazy competition, right? But everybody that I know down there is in like the 500 and below category. Nobody is building, you know, $2 to $3 million spec homes at scale, right? Like, I mean, there's a few guys down there doing it, obviously, but in terms of our world, the real estate investor world, like nobody touches that, right? So you've got just normal competition levels from normal builders there. You don't have that mecca, that craziness that is in the sub 500 category, where if you want to go try and flip in Phoenix, you know, good luck, you're jousting against everybody, right? So as you move up price point, the point that I'm trying to illustrate here is that you've got a lot less competition. If you are good at finding deals in the low price point, which is, by the way, the hardest price point to find them in, you can easily go find deals as you move up into the higher price points. You can put those same skills to work to do that. And so my suggestion to you would be gradually grow and push up price point. And then as you do that, you know, just make sure that you're growing your real estate IQ, your design IQ. Like you need a few other pieces in play, right? Like you can't just do the builder basic model. Like a lot of people that flip houses, they run the same flooring, same countertop, same cabinet, same hardware, same paint colors. Like they run that model on everything because it's simplicity. And I get it. It's like conveyor belt rent, you know, rehabbing. But if you're going to move into the higher end, you have to abandon that model to some extent. You really do. You have to have a little more thought, you have to have a lot more thought put into each of your products and not just have it all fit within the same box, right? And so that's why, like, you know, we really run a completely different business compared to most people that are flipping houses, because we don't have that. I mean, we have our go-to picks on some stuff, but literally every house is its own special thumbprint, right? But we can warrant doing that because we're in higher price points. If we were doing hood houses still, we could do all that work, but the market's really not going to reward us anymore. Like we could do an okay job with design. We could do like a gimmicky, you know, wall of tongue and groove or something like that, or shiplap, right? Just throw it up randomly one place in the house, and our buyer's going to walk in and be like, "Ooh, I saw that on Fixer Upper. Ooh, that's cool." Even though it may not fit at all right there, the color's terrible. It doesn't matter, because your buyer's IQ is so low in comparison to the higher price point. It doesn't matter, right? So it doesn't warrant putting all that extra effort into the lower end houses. If they're clean and new looking, they sell the same as if they've got all kinds of crazy design stuff that you put in them.
No, man, that's really cool. And I did notice that when I was looking through the houses you guys have developed and, you know, flipped and things like that, I did notice that none of them were the same. So that's very interesting. And I didn't notice that until you said that now, right? So that's really cool. And so let's say somebody was on here listening right now and they said, "Well, listen, my IQ whenever it comes to designing and, you know, creativity is zero, right?" And so this is, you know, just what are some tips? I think I know what you would say, but what are some tips you would give for those people that are like, "Hey, you know, I'm wanting to scale up, but my IQ in that area is zero."
I mean, these days, there's so many resources. You know, Pinterest is a huge one. You know, Instagram, God, there's so many design people. I mean, the world of design, because my wife runs our Instagram page for the design side of our business, which is TTM Home Design. And like, you know, she's interwoven with a bunch of other design people. Like that world is huge now. It's giant. And probably partly to do with, you know, Fixer Upper and Chip and Joanna Gaines and all that. It kind of exploded the world of like everybody wants to be a designer of some sort. But you have all these resources at your fingertips that are easy to access and just kind of start to absorb. Like you can't go look at this stuff and just within a day be like, "Oh, I get it all," right? Like you have to kind of chip away at it. Just like, you know, for example, I look at Redfin every day and I see what's come on the market, what's pending, what's sold, you know, just to kind of keep a real close pulse on our farm areas of exactly what's on the market and what's moving, right? Same thing, but you're also going to need to hire different team members as you kind of move up price point too, right? Like most people's model is just hire a GC. Here's the builder basic breakdown pages of exactly what we want. Put this in the house and that's it, right? Well, as you move up price point, you do bigger projects and you really try and set your product apart from the competition, you're going to have to bring in some type of design help more than likely. You can't self-design everything. It's just, you can't do everything in your business, right? So you're probably going to have to bring in some, you're going to have to hire a designer to some extent. You know, it just so happens that my wife is also a designer, but some people bring in outside design help and, you know, then they have them work with their GC or whoever, which honestly can be a little bit of a friction filled relationship a lot of the time, which is why we also have general contracting in house. So I have the construction contractor's license for the business, and we basically GC all our own projects we have for 12, 11 years now, something like that. So, you know, as you move up price point, that's something to think about as well. And as you, even if you're in the lower price points, you know, GCing your own jobs at some point, it just depends on what your goals are, what you want your business to look like. That was one of the things that we wanted to eliminate, was the kind of the GC friction factor, right? Which, right. You know, the reality of the construction game is that if GCs can work for homeowners, they will, because they can charge them like three times what they charge investors. And, you know, it's probably about the same pain in the ass, right? So, you know, you got to remember, you want everything done for cheap as an investor, but if you look at it from a GC's perspective, it's like, well, why would I work for investors if I could work for homeowners and make three times the money, sometimes more? Like, the amount of money that GCs are quoting homeowners right now to do stuff is crazy, right? They're making a lot of money. So, you know, food for thought there, but if you have a good GC relationship, I'd really covet that. And if you want to move up price point, look at bringing in some design help, because you definitely can't rely on your GC to do your design for you. That's for sure. So it's either got to be a combination of you and a designer, or maybe just a designer if you feel like you really are kind of inept in that area.
Love it. Great advice. Find people on your team to complement your weaknesses while you can focus on your strengths. I love that. Yeah. So let's dive into the Driving for Dollars app. So what brought that about? What was the idea behind creating an app where you can go driving for dollars and tag houses on the road? What was that all about?
Well, it was this crazy idea I had about 7 years ago when there was this, there was no technology, right? It's crazy how much this world has changed since we first had that idea about 7 years ago. You know, the thought process of having an app that tracks where you drive and being able to touch, you know, a property from an overhead view and have a Google Street View shot come up and then be able to add that to a list and then be able to use an API to essentially skip trace that on the spot. Like, those were crazy ideas back then, right? Now, it's a normal thing, right? With all the tech that's in this business, it's like, it's fairly normal. But ultimately, what the reason why we built that app was, it was an internal app that we used for our company, and we still do, because we essentially, our marketing is, it's not like go pull a giant list and market to everybody. It's never been that, right? It's been determine our exact farm areas that we want to be. And we used to be in a lot more farm areas than we are now, but determine our exact farm areas, i.e. pockets, parts of town, whatever. And then let's go extract all of the investment grade product out of those areas, right? And part of investment grade product is visually unappealing, right? Something about it is visually distressed. And so the Driving for Dollars leads are all visual distress type leads. Distress can vary. You know, it could be an old beat up Buick in the driveway to a complete piece of crap that's, the roof is, you know, hasn't been replaced in 50 years and it's overgrown. It could be any number of things or anywhere in between that, right? There's multiple tells that, you know, reasons why somebody would add it to the list. Or it could be a teardown property. It could be a smaller house in a higher end area on a normal size lot that could be torn down. But what we had done for a number of years from 2012 or 2010 to 2014, when we got that first build done, was basically drive around, use yellow pads, write down addresses, come back to the office, look up the owners, and then mail them letters of some sort to try and get them to respond. Skip tracing at that point wasn't even a thing. Didn't exist yet, right? So the first iteration of the app was simply to create a list of properties and then use an API to find out who owns it and where their mailing address is. That was the first iteration, right? And then, of course, that's changed over time. And, you know, ultimately we could integrate skip tracing in with it. And so it's just been this growth process of what the tech provides, but also just to, you know, make it easier on us and other investors to build these custom Driving for Dollars lists. Because the biggest pain in the butt part of Driving for Dollars used to be driving around, writing down the addresses, and then usually those addresses sit on a pad somewhere until you actually have time to go do the research to get all that information. Now that's a thing of the past. Don't need it anymore. So it's a real simple process now, and we've made it really cheap as well. So people can use the Driving for Dollars app and just drive around, pin a bunch of properties, create a list, run the list, skip trace them. And then from there, you can either, you know, mail people, you can ringless voicemail people, you can cold call people, you can text people, you can do all the things now that people do to generate deals in a very quick, concise, timeline, whereas before it was a huge pain in the butt, and usually it took you a long time to actually get to marketing those people.
Right, and they can do all that from the app, right?
Exactly, yeah. So, and now the newest iteration, because it's, you know, it's grown over time, is as of January, probably next Monday. So it's not only going to be a contact app, right? Because ultimately the original function of the app was to find out who owns it. Then it turned into find out who owns it, how you can contact them other than just mailing them, right? So it gives you all of their contact information. Now it's going to give you all of the property information as well, in addition to all the underlying mortgage information. So you get, now it's a contact and information app kind of fused into one, in addition to an organization app. So it's, you know, the tech side of this business has been crazy. The roller coaster of tech that's kind of come into this, especially the last 3 years. But, you know, we continue to kind of grow it, improve it, better it, and just kind of keep up with what technology allows us to do.
Love it, man. So everybody who's on here listening to this, I want you to go download it. It can be found in every app store, right? On mobile devices.
Yep. You just search for Driving for Dollars app. We actually own the trademark on that phrase. So nobody else can use it, which was just something that we kind of did along the way. Now it turns out that, you know, it's fairly valuable as well. So that's kind of cool. But yeah, you'll find it in both the iTunes store and the Google Play store. You just got to search Driving for Dollars app.
Awesome. Yeah. A while back, I can't remember, a couple months ago, we actually did a podcast about Driving for Dollars, you know, about, you know, things to look out for and, you know, just how you can make Driving for Dollars effective. And listen, this app, guys, can be a great tool for you to go out and find those distressed properties. Cause there's a lot of you all right now that have low budgets and you can't afford to be, you know, sending out, you know, tons of different marketing pieces that these, you know, gurus and people talk about you need to be sending out. Listen, why don't you start basic and start with Driving for Dollars, right? You have a car, more than likely you have a route to work. Why don't you use something like the Driving for Dollars app to, you know, make more money, you know, with less of a budget. So I would highly recommend it. I've actually used your app before, Tucker. So it works very well. You guys can check it out in all the app stores. That's just a little plug for you, man.
No, I appreciate it. Yeah, one guy before this whole corona mess, I did a speaking gig and he came up to me. He's like, "Hey, I used the app. I was on the spot. I pinned this house. I ran the skip trace, got the phone number, called him, and the guy said he'd be willing to sell. I'm meeting him next week." I was like, it's exactly what it's meant for, right? Speed up that process of communicating with people. So there you go.
So what percentage of deals that you do you think come from Driving for Dollars? I know that's probably changed over time.
Yeah, fairly high. So our marketing machine now, it used to be exclusively Driving for Dollars leads. And the reason was is because we were kind of spread out around town. Now we're in an area that has about 40, 45,000 person population. That's it. Right. Which, you know, for a lot of people's marketing model, that's way too small. They need 100,000 leads, right? Not just population, in order to run their machine. And so what we've done is we basically created segments of this area or pockets of this area that we've created D4D lists in every one of those pockets. Right. But there's only so many leads that you can get on D4D. So that's one aspect of our marketing machine. Then we pull some specialty lists on top of that. So ones that maybe, you know, D4D is visually unappealing or visually some sort of distress, right? But there's other leads that, you know, maybe on D4D, but also on these other kind of specialty lists, or there's other ones that are just on these specialty lists that maybe, you know, for whatever reason you drove by and you didn't think, maybe it was just dated on the outside, right? But maybe the inside there's more issues, or maybe there's more opportunity on paper with that versus visually. So what we do is we basically built out all of our Driving for Dollars lists all over Lake Oswego here. And then we've also pulled specialty filtered lists and some more generic filtered lists as well. But we basically market to the filtered lists and we market to the D4D leads and we stack those as well. So we basically then are able to identify ones that are on the D4D list, for example. Maybe they're on a related party list as well. So like it maybe looks bad. Related party list is basically just a list where property is sold for an absurdly low amount or a low amount within the last 10 years. And so usually that's some sort of a related party transaction, right? Mom sold it to son, you know, aunt sold it to nephew, whatever it is. And so those are fantastic leads on their own. But when they're visually unappealing, i.e. on the driving for dollars list and on a related party list, you know, that's an even better lead. You know, some of the other lists that we have, like we market to trust owned properties is a big thing. We've done that for a long time. You know, we've pulled lists that are like, unknown equity, unknown ownership time. So it's called the unknown list, which is basically just somebody that's owned a property for a very long time. It's probably free and clear. So there's all these, they're filtered lists, but they're kind of specialty filtered lists. So we have our D4D leads, and then we have these other filtered lists, and we kind of combine them. And then that is what we run our marketing machine to.
I love it, man. I love it. Well, thanks so much for sharing, you know, just a little bit about what you do and, you know, about your company that you're building, man. It's exciting. I've been keeping up with you for a while through email, which he actually has a really good email list you can sign up for. I've been following him on social media and everything like that. So guys, Tucker is the man to follow whenever it comes to this. And I know you have a podcast as well, right? So tell our listeners real quick, you know, about your podcast that you run and what they could find in that podcast.
For sure. Yeah. One of the things that we started over this journey was the Real Deals podcast, which is a national show, of course, likely where you found me. But it's basically all about my journey in real estate investing. You know, for the first 6-7 years, it was just me as the host. And then, you know, obviously we've done a lot of interviews as well. I probably did about 300 and some episodes. And then at that point, earlier this year, I decided to kind of hand off the hosting duties. So now we have a new iteration of the show, which is two younger hosts, Elliot and Cole, that are kind of on their journey in this business, right? And so they each run, you know, a slightly different version of a real estate investing business than myself, but there's a lot to learn from them as well. So we're behind the scenes, we're doing the production, and we're helping kind of make the show as good as it can be. But there's 300 and some episodes where you can just listen to me talk as well, which is probably more than enough. And, you know, I go through every topic of real estate investing you could possibly need to know. But it's called the Real Deals Podcast, and it's in the iTunes store and every other place that you can find podcasts.
Awesome. Well, Tucker, thanks so much for coming on, man. I really appreciate you talking about, you know, investing in the higher end homes and, you know, just sharing your experience in real estate and what strategies you're using to build wealth. Where can people follow you at, you know, if they're wanting to, you know, stay connected with you?
Yeah. You know, Facebook has probably been my main place. I know a lot of people, you know, Instagram is where they spend a lot of their time, but I've built most of my following on Facebook. So you can find me there. I am on Instagram. Not as much, but obviously, you know, I responded to you there. I do answer messages and whatnot. So, I'm kind of maxed out on friends on Facebook, but send me a friend request. And if you look normal, I'll scrub somebody off that maybe isn't normal and add you to it. But you can also, just follow me on Instagram as well and message me there. But those are probably the best two places.
Awesome. Well, guys, make sure you go follow him, you know, friend him, whatever one you do. Tucker is going to be a great asset for your real estate education as you're growing your business yourself. Listen, his podcast, the Driving for Dollars app, and just his journey in general could be a great way for you to stay motivated and go out there and learn things that you didn't know before. So, Tucker, thanks so much for coming on, man. I really appreciate you sharing your journey, and we hope you have a great New Year's, brother.
Appreciate you having me, and hope everybody out there, including yourself, has a great New Year's as well.
All right. Thanks, brother. And everybody that's listening right now, if you liked this show, if you liked, you know, what we're doing currently, if you like that we're streaming live now on my personal Facebook page and our YouTube channel, and if you like that we're doing these in audio, leave us a message or, you know, comment, subscribe, do something, engage with us, and let us know that you like this show so that we can keep making more of these in the future. 2021, we have a lot of episodes coming up. We have tons of investors coming on here to speak about how they're investing in real estate and making money. People from like Jason Pritchard, Chris Rood, a bunch of other people that are coming on this year. So you want to make sure you subscribe to this podcast to get more of these every Tuesday morning. So God bless you guys. We'll see you very soon on another episode of the Real Estate Success Strategies Podcast.